The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, America's New Main Streets, COVID's Boom Towns and Bus. 2 years on, the pandemic has redefined the way people live and work, and it's reshaped many of America's cities in the process. And this special report begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. Welcome to Post-COVID America. Incredibly, the pandemic didn't trigger a new American depression, but neither did it leave the country unscathed. Here's how COVID-19 continues to redraw the U.S. map. And this is written by Joel Stinnett. It took Daryl Deke nearly 10 years, thousands of referrals, and $275 million of assets under management to build his investment firm into a California success story. It took one virus for him to pack it up and move across the country. COVID-19 allowed me to move to Nashville, says Deke, whose new market wealth management firm was brought by Raleigh-based CapTrust Financial Advisors as part of the move. 2 years ago, I would have had to get on a plane or drive to a client's office for a meeting. There's no way they would have been comfortable doing business on Zoom. That's all changed. Change has been the one constant for businesses since the pandemic took hold in the U.S. 2 years ago this month. Although life since then has sometimes seemed on pause, business and innovation have only ramped up. Industries have adopted new technologies to operate in a remote world. Thousands of laid-off employees have become overnight entrepreneurs, and Midwestern and Southeastern towns in particular have surged with new residents at the expense of traditionally bigger and wealthier coastal giants. The rise of remote work has enabled employees to do their jobs thousands of miles away from their bosses, allowing some high-income workers to move to more affordable locales. In New York City, residents fled to the nearby suburbs, such as New Haven, Connecticut. More flew south to warmer areas, such as Miami. In Los Angeles, thousands of people left California's beaches for Phoenix's sandy desert. These disruptive ingredients are creating a new generation of boom towns while leaving other markets on the verge of a bust. Metros such as the Triangle, Las Vegas, and Orlando, Florida, have continued to see their populations grow even as the pandemic suffocated travel and business. Others, including Baltimore, Detroit, and Cleveland, are experiencing a migration away from their once bustling borders. Like world wars and economic depressions of the past, pressures created by the global COVID crisis could affect which industries and which cities dominate the next decades of life in America. There's opportunities we've never seen before, but it's not like everyone's going to automatically be a winner, Richard Florida, a noted urbanist, says. The winners are going to be the ones that are really strategic and intentional, identifying those industries, those clusters, those talent bases, the ways to make their quality of life or quality of place better to attract talent. And yeah, he continues, in a way it's a better competition, but it's a tougher competition. The business of moving. Adriana Cruz's office phone wouldn't stop ringing. The U.S. was barely a month into the pandemic while many states were sheltering in place. Texas was beginning to reopen. Governor Greg Abbott allowed retailers to open under a to-go model and established a strike force of medical experts and community leaders to advise him on how to open the rest of the state. For Cruz, Texas's executive director of economic development and tourism, the moves proved more popular than fried Oreos at the Rodeo Houston. We've seen the increase in the level of interest in Texas from a business perspective that really take off after March 2020, Cruz says. At the beginning of the pandemic, what we were hearing from companies, they were calling our office and saying, my state is shut down. I'm questioning why I'm located where I am. I can't operate. And of course, we were welcoming them to Texas. A record number of businesses started in Texas in 2021 with more than 1,100 expansions or relocations to the state, creating $68 billion in capital investment and more than 60,700 jobs. Texas tops a long list of southern states that have seen population increases in the past 2 years, with individuals and companies drawn by low taxes, a high quality of life, and the new freedom of remote work. Other regions, including Charlotte, Phoenix, and Nashville, Tennessee, also have seen their populations grow during the pandemic, often at the expense of large metros like San Francisco and New York City. For example, Austin, Texas's population grew 3% from July 2019 to July 2020, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, whereas San Francisco's declined by 0.57%. However, migrations from big cities is nothing new, says Brookings Institution Senior Fellow William Fry, a demographer focused on migration, immigration, and urban demographics. What is new is the decline of immigration into the U.S. and therefore into big cities where immigrants typically first settle because of policies enacted at the beginning of the pandemic. Frey says estimates show a net U.S. migration of 256,000 people from 2020 to 2021, down from more than 1 million a year during the previous decade. The pandemic has been less a reshuffling of the U.S. population and more an acceleration of long-term trends, he says. There's been much more movement out of places like California, New York, Illinois, and I think some of it has to do with the pandemic, safety concerns, people deciding they could live away from work or maybe retiring early, Fry says. But the pandemic has more or less just magnified things that were going on before. I think we'll get to where we were before, but it still will mean that there is growth in the Southeast, he adds. Stimulating real estate. Empty skyscrapers, abandoned offices, foreclosed homes. The potential catastrophic consequences of the pandemic on local real estate markets were easy to imagine in the spring of 2020 as businesses sent workers home. But for many areas, potential busts turned into very real booms. When the pandemic hit, demand in all of the sectors just dropped off, CBRE Global Chief Economist Richard Barkum says. We had expected quite a big hit to demand. We had expected vacancy rates to rise, but because of the government stimulus, because of the vaccines came along, the real severe hit to real estate was confined to one quarter. When the stimulus came in, it was quite clear that after one quarter, demand was picking up again and economic growth was picking up. That rebound has extended from commercial real estate to U.S. home prices. From December 2020 to December 2021, home values nationally jumped by 19.6%. Most large metros outpaced that, according to an analysis of Zillow Group Incorporated data. Since March 2020, 13 of the largest 200 markets have seen home values increase by more than 30%, led by Austin and Phoenix and followed by a number of Southeast cities. Commercial real estate has mirrored that trend, with U.S. real estate transactions crossing the $250 billion mark in 2021 for the first time, according to CBRE research. Pre-pandemic, that annual number was hovering around $160 billion. Those record-breaking figures suggest that real estate demand has returned in a big way, erasing fears of empty downtowns and neighborhoods filled with foreclosures. However, demand is not spread evenly. Barkum says retail, hotel, industrial, and office real estate are recovering at different rates, which he said also holds true for regions of the country. Recovery investment has very differently favored the Sun Belt cities over 2021, Barkum says. We see investment moving to the reopening of big coastal cities such as New York, San Francisco, and San Jose in 2022. But investors were really focused on apartment and industrial real estate and the Sun Belt cities in 2021. Funding the future. If 2020 was the year of PPP, 2021 was the year of the VC. Venture capital gave a breakthrough injection of cash to growing companies last year, closing more than 14,000 deals worth more than $300 billion, according to PitchBook Incorporated. That dollar amount is more than double the amount of investment the year before the pandemic. Traditional high rollers such as San Francisco, $93.1 billion, and New York City, $51.9 billion, led the way. But up-and-coming startup hubs such as Raleigh, $1.6 billion, Columbus, Ohio, $1.5 billion, Portland, Oregon, $1.3 billion, Minneapolis, $1.3 billion, and Durham, $1.2 billion also made big splashes. Billion-dollar investments like those are typically a precursor to explosive growth and could signal which markets are primed for post-pandemic success. However, those big investments don't always trickle into the pockets of workers in those cities. Gus Foucher, chief economist at the PNC National Financial Services Group, says the pandemic has created a workforce shortage, forcing businesses to invest in equipment and technology instead of hiring. Investment in equipment rose 5% since the pandemic started, according to Deloitte Insights. If you want to increase output but you can't find the labor, you can invest in ways that make your existing workers more productive, Foucher says. That's been an area where we've seen strong growth, but it hasn't been more pronounced in some parts of the country than others. I think everywhere is experiencing labor shortages right now. As for Deke, the newly relocated financial advisor, his investment in Nashville is paying off for him and his family. It worked out phenomenally well for our firm to be able to relocate to Nashville because of the people, Deke says. I was in Atlanta in the mid-1980s, and Atlanta was exploding with growth. Frankly, that's what Nashville feels like to me. Nashville is exploding with opportunity, Deke concludes, and Nashville is hardly alone. And also part of this special report is a Q&A with Richard Florida, headlined, An Upside for Downtowns in COVID's Wake. Richard Florida is certain America's cities will emerge from the pandemic and its 2 years of economic disruption bigger and stronger than ever. And so as to what that might look like, well, it's still a work in progress, he says. During an exclusive online event hosted by the Business Journals, Florida channeled his nearly four decades of experience as a reputed urbanist, author, educator, and consultant to expound on the historic moment of the nation's cities now find themselves in. Ever the optimist, it's an opportunity that will trigger the kind of innovation and expansion America is best known for, he predicts. There will be trade-offs. Florida concedes some regions will win, others will struggle. He also is quick to note that mounting concerns over wealth inequity, crime, and economic displacement are not going to solve themselves. And still, he is optimistic. Florida's interview was moderated by Atlanta Business Chronicle broadcast editor Crystal Edmondson. What follows is an edited transcript of their conversation. We had you on about a year ago, and I'm wondering, were there any things that surprised you during the past 12 months, or was it pretty much what you expected? Well, I think the fundamental trends affecting the way we work, offices, how businesses treat and manage their employees, the reshaping of cities and suburbs, I think those fundamental trends and the migratory patterns we've seen are in place. Those are pretty much the same, but I think the Omicron variant that really surged in December threw me for a complete loop. I wasn't ready for it. I think what's happened is it's made people think, we're not over this thing. There's going to be waves in the winter months. It's going to be endemic. And instead of the fact that we're vaccinated, and it's all behind us, we're figuring out as individuals, as business people, as city leaders, that we're going to have to manage this pandemic in a better way. And maybe that's the way it has to be. You described it as the great unmooring. Can you unpack that? Tell me what you mean by that. Well, I've been working in this field for a few decades, and I actually wrote a book over a dozen years ago called Who's Your City? In that book, I said, look, folks, you make three big decisions in your life, where you get an education and go to work, who you pick for your life partner, and where you choose to live. And I said, no one takes the third one seriously. They think a lot about the first two, then they don't take the third one seriously, and they just go. No one paid attention until the COVID pandemic, and now everyone wants to talk about this. That's why I called it the great unmooring. I've never seen anything like this, where almost everyone, moms and dads, young single people, empty nesters, is just asking deep questions about how do I live, how do I work, where do I live? Part of that is the rise of remote work. But I don't think that's the whole ball of wax. I think people, for the first time, are really asking deep questions about their lives. A lot of downtown areas and major cities are asking some of these questions. Can you talk about what cities should consider if they want to bring people back to their downtown areas? The way I like to think about it is that packing and stacking of office workers is the last gasp of the old industrial area. In cities, we used to pack and stack workers in factories, and then those factories closed, and the factories moved out to the suburbs or to the Sun Belt or ultimately to Asia. And then in city after city, we reused those factories as housing, as offices, as art galleries. Well, the same thing's happening now because of remote work, and remote work really gives office workers the option, the opportunity, to work remotely. So yeah, I think our downtowns are going through a fundamental change. The point here is that we've misunderstood downtowns as either places to go to work or, in some cases, just places to live. What really distinguishes downtowns is that they are centers for human connection and human connectivity, and that's their future. I think their future is bright. I think downtowns have the best locations. They're served by the best roads and the best transit. They have the best architecture. They often have a lot of great nightlife, like stadiums and cultural institutions around them. If they play their hand right, they can come back stronger. So how are companies going to get people back? I mean, it's not just about COVID. It doesn't seem like people are leery of getting close to other. It doesn't seem like people are leery of getting close to other people at this point. There's something else going on. Turn on your TV, watch a basketball game, or watch the Super Bowl. Packed to the rafters, even the cultural facilities. Broadway is back, operas are back, restaurants are packed, people go into clubs. The only thing that's not packed is the office. That should tell you something. Companies are learning they're going to have to entice workers back to the office to get people in, especially on Monday and Friday. Maybe it's educational offerings or an on-site MBA. You bring a fitness instructor and do yoga or spinning or have a wine and cheese. It's going to be a combination of remaking the office to be a center of connection and programming the office to excite people. The office of the future isn't an office. I think it's a community. I think that's what we're getting to. It's not just build a skyscraper, build an office building, and people come in. It really is building a community of offerings, and it's all going to be about managing connections, and I think that's the real role of the city. As we wrap up, can you tell me what are three things that maybe real estate pros or economic developers should be looking out for in the next 12 months or so? Well, real estate developers must realize we have to build more mixed-use developments, more mixed-use communities where we can work, live, and play. The old idea that a building had a specific use, it was either residential or office, that's blurring. Secondly, categories of real estate that we used to think were important, industrial, commercial, residential, is blurring. Is a grocery store commercial anymore, or is a grocery store filled with pickers from Instacart and Grocery Gateway, whatever they are, essentially a warehouse? And for the political folks, it's no longer about incentives. Workers are now mobile. They can choose where they want to live. And when we're talking about talent development and quality of place, it's about the offerings. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Shop can't keep flags in stock. And this is under the hashtag PrayForUkraine. A downtown Raleigh store that has been selling flags since 1969 is having a hard time keeping Ukrainian flags in stock. Jesse Murphy, who started the Capital Flag and Flagpole Company after returning from a stint in the U.S. Navy, sold his last 3x5-foot Ukrainian flag on the morning of March 9 and had only two small Ukrainian flags still in stock. Murphy says he could have sold 200 or 300 of the blue and yellow flags, but suppliers, still slowed by the pandemic, can't keep up with demand. His last shipment was only 6 of the larger 3x5 sizes. A lot of people wanted 2x3s, he says. Murphy moved into the house that is his current location on Lane Street in 1976, and the shop retains its old Raleigh feel. Much of his business comes from installing and maintaining flagpoles for corporate clients, but he has plenty of American, international, and historical flags for people who want to walk in and poke around. Like so many small business owners, the pandemic was a blow as supply chains tightened. The demand has really gone up and the supply is down, Murphy says, noting that he anticipated that and stocked up on American flags. He plans to keep his flags flying at his current location despite high demand for the space. Glenwood Avenue is only a block away, and his taxes have risen from around $300 a year when he moved in to nearly $15,000 now. As he gulps, "I'm asset rich and income poor." Longtime Sanford mayor decides not to run again. Chet Mann, who has been mayor of Sanford since 2013 and overseen tremendous growth in the town, will not seek re-election for a third term. Mann cited spending more time with his family and his business as reasons for not seeking another term, leading the fast-growing Lee County City. Two current Sanford City Council members, Sam Gaskins and Rebecca Wyhoff Salmon, have announced for the city's Democratic primary May 17. Under Mann's watch, the city of about 30,000 people has seen multiple life sciences companies, including Abzena and Astellas, announce intentions to put facilities in Sanford that will bring hundreds of high-paying jobs to the city. European flights still planned. Rising fuel prices haven't altered plans for a return to direct flights from Raleigh-Durham International Airport to London and Paris, at least not yet. We're closely monitoring the fuel price situation and haven't made any changes to our plans to restart service between RDU and London on June 3rd, American Airlines spokesman Brian Medham says. At Delta Airlines, the airline will plans to restart the Paris flight August 3rd. But Brett Snyder, president of airline industry blog Cranky Flyer, notes that there's just no way to know at this point what the airlines are thinking. There's no question that the rise in the cost of jet fuel will make airlines reconsider some of their marginal growth plans going in the midterm, he says. Whether that will impact RDU or not remains to be seen. Black Dollar Corporation lands new location. A local entrepreneur is building on early successes in downtown Raleigh with a new space leased and plans for a creator space to operate out of a historic building. Earlier this year, Johnny Hackett's Black Dollar Corporation leased the textbook building at 811 West Hargett Street from Carpenter Development in a partnership with Allison Gray and David Moore to serve as the company's new headquarters and feature a new creator space called The Factory. Built in 1920 as a textbook storage building, the structure includes 9,000 square feet of commercial space. Hackett launched the Black Friday Market on Hargett Street, which sells products from black-owned businesses, according to a release. He expects the factory to be fully up and running in May. Partnership is a boost for students. Looks like folks at Wake Ed Partnership are ready to match some Triangle companies with high school students as it fast-tracks its Career Accelerator program developed with the Wake County Public School System. CEO Keith Poston tells Biz, the education advocacy groups need local businesses willing to host students and teachers for immersive experiences in person or virtual. Wake Ed also wants these companies to help with guest speaking and panel participation to lead workshops for students focused on developing their career pathways. Having trouble finding workers, this may be one of the ways to bolster that workforce pipeline and contribute to a good cause that helps the community. Apple's Triangle impact growing. Apple's announcement last year that it would bring 3,000 employees to the Triangle continues to reverberate, with TBJ hearing the company may be seeking as much as 150,000 square feet of additional temporary space in Cary. That would be in addition to the MetLife space in Cary that Apple plans to renovate. The MetLife building totals 219,000 square feet of Class A office space. Additional details about the lease terms were not available, and Apple always keeps its plans quiet. But as new Cary Chamber of Commerce President Mark Lawson notes, Apple is actively recruiting in our market. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger. New tower to become Swank Durham spot. The Novus will rise 27 stories and feature apartments, condos. A new 27-story high-rise in downtown Durham is set to break ground next month as demolition wraps up on the site slated for the development. Developer Austin Lawrence Partners is clearing what remains of the old South Bank site with plans to start construction on The Novus in April. Construction is expected to wrap up in 2024. The property is situated at 400 West Main Street at Durham's Five Points intersection. Pricing for the apartments has yet to be determined. Condo prices range from $800 to $900 per square foot, with unit sizes ranging from 750 to 5,500 square feet, including two penthouses. ALP Principal Jane Hill says more than half of the condos have already been reserved. Listings show some units going for well above $3 million. There's also a second phase planned next door to the Novus. ALP plans to build a 12-story tower on that site, although few additional details were available. Demolition has been ongoing for weeks. Initial plans called for the building to be imploded, but those plans were scrapped due to the concerns regarding the impact to surrounding structures. Everyone wanted us to implode it, and so did we. We thought that'd be fun, Hill says. There's just so many historic buildings in downtown Durham, and with the fact there would be lots of vibration, lots of dust with that, we didn't want to close down the city or do damage to other assets in Durham. The rest of the site should be cleared in the next 2 weeks, she says. The project has been nearly a decade in the making. ALP first bought the property in 2013 for $6 million, according to Durham County records, and has been planning to redevelop the site for years. Greensboro-based Samet Corporation is the contractor. LS3P Architects, with offices in Raleigh, is the architect. Raleigh Ironworks seeks 20-story zoning for future phase with denser development. The developers behind a big mixed-use project underway along Atlantic Avenue in Raleigh are planning a future phase that could have taller, denser development. Jamestown of Atlanta and Grub Ventures of Raleigh kicked off construction on the first phase of Raleigh Ironworks last year. Looking ahead, the group is eyeing taller buildings with a rezoning request to allow development up to 20 stories high for portions of the site slated for Phase 2. Those portions make up 8.5 acres at 1120 East Whitaker Mill Road and 2200 Ironworks Drive. The firms have yet to announce a timeline or site plans for the second phase of the project, but have said it could include more than 350,000 square feet of office space and additional residential units. Kane Realty plans to build a new project at Dix Park. As work kicks off on the first phase of Park City South by Dorothea Dix Park in Raleigh, developer Kane Realty Corporation has unveiled plans for phase two of the large project. Plans call for a 20-story mixed-use tower with around 375 apartments and over 1,500 square feet of ground-level retail. The project is situated at the corner of Lake Wheeler Road and South Saunders Street. Work is expected to kick off on phase two of the by the end of this year, with the first tenants expected in the spring of 2025. Designs include a courtyard that will connect to the first phase to create an outdoor destination space along the city's Greenway Trail system and South Saunders Street. Work on phase one is underway and features a 335-unit mid-rise apartment building with 18,000 square feet of ground-level retail and flex office space, plus a host of outdoor amenities and walking trail connectivity. J. Davis Architects is the architect on phase one. And finally, we have a big number, 264. The number of units that will be at Atlantic Springs Place Apartments in Raleigh, which is being developed by Dominion Realty Partners, DRP, recently bought the property at 5501 and 5591 Atlantic Springs Road, the site of the defunct AMC movie theater, for $7.9 million. The movie theater closed in 2020. Dominion plans to deliver the first units in the fall of next year. And now we turn to the On Greater Triangle Growth page, written by Evan Hoopfer. Industrial facility planned near Benson. Raleigh's Edgewater Ventures plans a space with 500,000 square feet. A huge industrial facility that could support hundreds of jobs is coming to Johnston County. Raleigh-based Edgewater Ventures is planning to invest $40 million to build an approximately 500,000 square-foot speculative industrial facility near Benson. The Johnston County Board of Commissioners agreed to provide the project with economic incentives during its March 7 meeting. The site has the ability to expand up to nearly 1.1 million square feet. Even at 501,120 square feet, it's really the largest speculative facility ever built in the Raleigh-Durham MSA, says Chris Norvell, a partner at Edgewater Ventures. The plan is to break ground in the May-June timeframe and be operational by Q1 2023. The project, called Cross Point Logistics Center, will sit near the Interstate 95 and I-40 interchange on a piece of property that an LLC addressed to Edgewater Ventures bought last October for just under $1.5 million. Norvell told the Johnston County Commissioners that the company searched up and down I-95 from Robson County to Nash County before deciding on the spot in Benson. Edgewater Ventures plans to invest roughly $40 million in the facility by December 2023 and attract at least 300 jobs by December 2026, according to the economic incentive package approved by the county on March 7. In exchange, the company will receive a grant equal to 50% of ad valorem taxes on eligible investments paid for 5 years beginning in 2024. It's exciting to see a high-quality developer like Edgewater Ventures investing so aggressively in Benson, a community that is poised for continued success as American businesses reconsider supply chains and look to build sustainable links to consumers now that the pandemic is behind us, says Chris Johnson, Economic Development Director for Johnston County. Moore County clears key hurdle to landing large industrial company. The town of Aberdeen was recently awarded a $167,670 grant from the North Carolina Railroad Company to clear 40 acres of the 128-acre Iron Horse Industrial Park. The town of Aberdeen is thrilled that after nearly 20 years of hoping for some kind of activity at Iron Horse, some dirt will finally be moved, Aberdeen Mayor Robbie Farrell says. Iron Horse sits in the southern part of Moore County near its border with Hope County at the intersection of NC Highway 211 and Carolina Road. The park is served by Aberdeen and Rockfish Railroad, a short line for CSX. Clearing the site will increase its curb appeal, something it's lacking today, says Natalie Hawkins, executive director of Moore County's economic development arm, Partners in Progress. She calls clearing the site the single largest barrier to marketing efforts. Once cleared, the 40-acre portion of the park can support construction of a 600,000-square-foot industrial building for one or multiple tenants. dozens of new homes targeted for Johnston County. A tiny town in Johnston County is being targeted for new homes. Plans for Wellens Park include 83 single-family homes ranging from 1,400 to 1,600 square feet, says Clifton Holloman, a land broker for National Land Realty, who represented the buyer in a recent transaction. The land is located in Micro, a small Johnston County town. The developer is Garner's Jones Creek LLC and Johnston County Records. Johnston County Records show the company bought the nearly 50 acres for $515,000, according to a deed filed March 1. Holloman says home prices will start in the upper 200,000s. The development timeline is 20 to 25 houses a year, starting in 2023. And now we have a section called She Said It. It's a quote from Southern Pines Mayor Carol Haney before voting yes on a 266-unit apartment complex, which was approved in a 4-to-1 vote. Do I want this personally? No, I don't. But legally, I don't see how we can't move forward. If I thought we had a chance to win in court, I'd go for it. But legally, the applicant has made a strong case for this project. And finally, a big number, 41. The number of new homes D.R. Horton is planning to build in Stantonsburg, located in southeastern Wilson County, near its border with Greene and Wayne counties. And now we turn to the On EcoDevo page and banking, written by Lauren Onisorge. The main headline, North Carolina misses on electric car jobs. Politics played key role in North Carolina missing out on large economic development projects. A pair of electric vehicle makers, Rivian and Ford Motor Company, considered and then rejected North Carolina for billions of dollars of investments, and public records show part of it was politics. Rivian, an Amazon-backed company that in December confirmed plans for a 7,500-job facility near Atlanta, took North Carolina off the site list because a state bill it thought could pass was never brought forward, records show. Similarly, communications for the state sent regarding its recruitment of Ford and its 5,800-job project mentioned the same political issue, calling into question future projects at a time when multiple electric vehicle manufacturers have shown interest in North Carolina. While negotiating with the state over potential incentives, records obtained through a Freedom of Information request show Rivian, which is also backed by Ford Motor Company, was in contact with Wake County State Representative Julie Von Hafen on a measure that would allow certain automakers to sell directly to customers rather than through auto dealers, potentially leveling the playing field, as Tesla had already negotiated the ability to have 6 direct sales centers in the state. That state law was passed in 2019. The new bill would have allowed Rivian the same opportunity, but it never materialized. North Carolina is one of several states with restrictions on direct sales for automakers. North Carolina also bans direct auto servicing. Georgia lawmakers have introduced a bill to allow electric vehicle makers to have unlimited dealer locations. Like North Carolina, the state currently allows Tesla to have a limited number of locations. Unfortunately, North Carolina's law as it currently stands would prohibit us from being able to do that, Rivian wrote the state. This issue alone is making it very hard for us to dive deeper. Ford considered North Carolina, but eventually picked Tennessee. They haven't taken us up on repeated invitations to meet, visit, engage, etc., i.e. the hallmarks of sincere interest in North Carolina as a potential location, EDPNC CEO Chris Chung wrote officials August 3rd about both Rivian and Ford. Raleigh's First Horizon leaders say TD Bank deal will drive growth, hiring. It was a day like no other for Laura Bunn, Triangle Market President for First Horizon Bank, who woke up February 28 to find her company was being sold to Toronto-based TD Bank. Bunn learned about the deal on the news before I actually read the announcement, and right away the deal price stuck out, $25 a share, one of the largest premiums for transactions over $2 billion in banking. I knew it was an exceptional offer and a real compliment to First Horizon, Bunn says. Over the ensuing days, the announcement has started to sink in. Executives from TD Bank have spoken to the staff. Bunn has had calls with her team and has spoken with First Horizon's management. First Horizon Corporation is headquartered in Memphis, Tennessee. Perhaps the biggest impact she has seen is the $150 million TD Bank is setting aside for retention, proof, she says, of the premium the acquirer is putting on her teammates. The bank has pledged to keep customer-facing personnel as well as to avoid branch shutdowns in the Triangle. The plan is growth, Bunn says. I know that TD is very interested not only in coming here and being part of the Triangle market, but also being a top performer in our sector in the Triangle. It's too early in the process to know the future operating model and the structure, but we know the plan is growth. RDU adds flights to Connecticut. Raleigh-Durham International Airport is getting a new airline this spring. The airport recently announced that Avelo Airlines is joining its carrier lineup with service to New Haven, Connecticut, starting in May and running 6 flights a week. The flights start with introductory fares of $59. The news comes amid a surge in jet fuel to a 13-year high. Bud Hafer, spokesman for Avelo, says it helps that the airline is flying fuel-efficient Boeing 737 aircraft. Rising prices aren't halting the airline's growth plans, he says. We're not here to steal market share from anybody, he says. We're here to grow and run our own race. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from James Sills, CEO of M&F Bank in Durham, on the talent crunch his industry is facing. We're competing against other financial institutions, tech firms, real estate companies, and it is hard. And finally, a big number, $2.5 million. That's the strategic investment tire giant Bridgestone Corporation made in Durham, tire sensor firm Tyrata, that's spelled T-Y-R-A-T-A, which has come a long way from its beginning as a tiny operation in a Duke University engineering lab. And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Education page, written by Zach Ezone. Amgen ramps up its plans in Holly Springs. The new facility is the global company's first in North Carolina. Global biotech Amgen has begun construction on a facility that will bring 355 new jobs to the Triangle by the end of 2025. The company held a groundbreaking ceremony March 7, recognizing the beginning of its $550 million investment in Wake County. Amgen is building the facility, its first in North Carolina, within Friendship Innovation Park in Holly Springs. The investment is in response to an increasing demand of the company's products, says Arlene Paulino, Amgen's Senior Vice President of Manufacturing. Amgen will manufacture the drug substance for multiple products within its portfolio at the facility. The company focuses on 6 therapeutic areas: cardiovascular disease, oncology, bone health, neuroscience, nephrology, and inflammation. Paulino expects the facility to touch on all of these areas. Increases in product demand varies within these therapeutic areas, varies by regions across the globe, but Paulino notes the company has seen continued growth in cardiovascular and oncology products. There are so many different cancers and tumors that the industry is trying to solve, and I think the need for oncology products across the globe is ever increasing, she says. Since announcing in August the facility over a Texas proposal that included $110 million worth of incentives, the company has focused on selecting a site, connecting with the community, and building a team. This team stands at about 10 to 15 people, but will likely grow to 25 to 30 by the end of this year, Paulino says. Amgen will ramp up its hiring efforts in 2023 and 2024 as it gets closer to being operational. The company is taking a hybrid approach with the site, which will support a combination of traditional stainless steel-fed batch manufacturing and single-use technologies intended to help meet environmental aspirations. The company plans to become carbon neutral by 2027 and reduce its water use and waste disposal by 40% and 70%, respectively. Large stainless steel facilities are really beneficial when you think of products that you have to have a big demand for, Paulino says. For some molecules, you can run the smaller, innovative technology, but it needs to be amenable to that process. Product sales for the company were flat between 2020 and 2021. This is due to a 7% growth in unit volumes being offset by a 7% decline in net selling price, according to a statement the company released in February with its 2021 financial results. Seqirus renews agreement with BARDA to supply flu vaccines. Seqirus has renewed a long-term agreement with the federal government to support the country's readiness in the event of an influenza pandemic. The drug manufacturer has renewed a 5-year deal with the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, allowing the agency to request Seqirus provide influenza vaccines and adjuvants used to broaden the body's immune response for pre-pandemic stockpiling or to support rapid response to an influenza epidemic. BARDA is a division of the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Under the deal, the company would produce up to 150 million influenza vaccine doses for individuals 6 months and older in a flu pandemic. The drug substance for those vaccines would be sourced from the facility in Holly Springs, says Dave Sagel, Vice President of Manufacturing and Site Head of the Holly Springs Manufacturing Facility. North Carolina's Medicaid transition highlighted. North Carolina's transition to Medicaid managed care has been relatively smooth despite some administrative burdens and communications challenges, a report finds. A coalition of managed care firms, community groups, and others called North Carolina for Better Medicaid, worked with Health Management Associates to evaluate the transition, which began in July. Benefits under the five plans offered by the organizations the state selected for this transition seem to line up with the needs of their clientele, and people haven't lost too much with their providers, which are both positive signs, says Kathleen Nolan with Health Management Associates. And now in a section called He Said It, a quote from Neil Fowler, CEO of Parthalis Pharma, on his decision to end his semi-retirement and join a late-stage biopharma startup with a product that's already approved in Japan. Fowler was previously the CEO of Morrisville-based Liquidia for 13 years before leaving the company in January 2021. I love building things. I love building teams. I still have every bit of the drive I had when I was 20 years old, and this was a great opportunity. And finally, big numbers. 22.1%. And 18.1%. That's how much the Triangle's two largest CROs, ICVIA Holdings and Syneos Health, respectively, grew their revenue last year from 2020. Both companies cite an increased demand for their services, partially fueled by the pandemic. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants section, written by Laura Brumette. Carrie's Cornerstone sold for $5.8 billion. Cornerstone Building Brands employs more than 20,000 people. Carrie's Cornerstone Building Brands Incorporated has agreed to a deal to sell the company to a private equity firm. The company is being bought by its largest shareholder, Clayton, Dubliner, and Rice, including the assumption of debt. The all-cash transaction is valued at $5.8 billion, the company's announced March 7. Cornerstone is the largest manufacturer of exterior building products in North America and has over 20,000 employees across all of its locations. Clayton Dubilier, and Rice and its affiliates currently own 49% of the company's outstanding shares of common stock. When the deal closes, Cornerstone will no longer be publicly traded. Shareholders will receive $24.65 in cash per share, a 16% premium over Cornerstone's closing price of $21.30 on March 4. Cornerstone's annual report showed $5.5 billion in net sales for 2021, a 20.9% increase from the previous year. The increase was credited to favorable price actions across all segments and strong underlying market demands. Pro forma adjusted EBITDA for the year was $688 million, an improvement of 24.1% from the previous year, driven by an increase in price mix, net of inflation, of 37.9%. However, the company also experienced higher manufacturing costs due to supply chain disruptions and labor constraints, the filing shows. The deal is expected to close in the second or third quarter of this year. In June 2021, Cornerstone sold a unit of its business for $1 billion. The 830-employee insulated metal panels outfit was purchased by Charlotte-based steelmaker Nucor in a cash transaction. The company said at the time that it planned to use the $750 million made on the deal to make payments on secured credit facilities, projects, and other acquisition efforts. Cornerstone was formed following a merger of NCI Building Systems Incorporated and Plygem Parent LLC in November of 2018. The company began trading under the Cornerstone name in May 2019. The company's headquarters is located at 5020 Weston Parkway in Cary. Boutique hotel could make way for 40-story tower. The Longleaf Hotel property in downtown Raleigh could be rezoned for a mixed-use development. The owners say the hotel isn't going anywhere. Loden Properties owns the 2-year-old boutique hotel and recently held a neighborhood meeting to discuss rezoning the property from a 12-story height limit to a 40-story limit. The rezoning request would allow for a mixed-use development. Russ Jones, partner at Loden Properties, is exploring the rezoning due to the city's favorable political climate. The current Raleigh City Council has approved multiple 40-story requests since its election in 2019, but patrons won't have to say goodbye to the hotel. We have a neon sign up there. It says, "Long Live Longleaf," Jones says. Longleaf isn't going anywhere. If there's a development in the future that can benefit from a 40-story rezoning, Longleaf is a part of that puzzle. Located at 300 North Dawson Street and 200 West Lane Street, the property totals 0.95 acres. Leadership shuffle at 45-year-old firm. A Raleigh-based supply chain consulting firm has named a new leader on the heels of a record year for business. Tompkins Solutions is a 45-year-old firm specializing in consulting services and material handling integration. David Latona has been appointed as president and CEO following Denny McKnight's retirement. The firm's revenue for 2021 was 3 times larger than anything the company had previously seen. Tompkins has seen long lead times and labor issues plaguing supply chains recently, making its services more valuable, Latona says. Now, the Russian invasion of Ukraine will likely cause another blow, Latona says, as many key metals being sourced from Ukraine will have a major impact on products. And in a section called She Said It, a quote from Chef Chidi Kumar, owner of downtown Raleigh restaurant Garland, on receiving her 5th James Beard Award nomination, and friend Susan Gerhardt of St. Roque Fine Oysters receiving his 1st. "I'm so excited to see his name on that list and so many people from this area. I love the community of chefs here." And finally, a big number, 21. The number of days until Carrie's Fenton development opens and its tenant lineup of specialty stores, entertainment spots, and local restaurants is almost complete. Spots such as Crawford Brothers Steakhouse, Paragon Theaters, and Lululemon will open April 1. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to our continuing series, 52 Shades of Success. The headline, A Purpose-Driven Recovery. A Veterans Life Center works to help at-risk veterans make the transition to a productive and self-reliant civilian life. Written by Connie Gentry. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ+ community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project will also delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. There were more than 19 million veterans in the U.S. at the end of 2021, but the Department of Veteran Affairs reports that there were only 1,303 total VA care sites. The vast majority of those veterans, roughly 18.5 million, served from the Vietnam era forward and have faced challenges in transitioning back to civilian life, unlike any of the previous generations. In particular, 21st century veterans have come home grappling with the emotional, mental, and physical scars of guerrilla warfare. Many struggling from post-traumatic stress syndrome, PTSD, the aftermath of traumatic brain injuries, TBIs, and moral injury. When the Veterans Life Center opened in 2020 in Butner, it set a new standard for the care and support provided at to at-risk 21st century veterans, many of whom were homeless. The co-ed residential facility works to help each veteran strengthen their mental and physical health, improve their life skills, and obtain the counseling, mentoring, and education needed to transition into a self-reliant civilian life. "They come here to change their lives, and we help each resident identify what they want to accomplish, what their goals are, and where they want to be in 5 years," says John Turner, executive director at the Veterans Life Center, or VLC. "What they all lack is the purpose, identity, and confidence to lead a personally satisfying life. When they come to the VLC, each of them commits to an individual Veterans Integration or IVR plan. That plan provides a roadmap for helping veterans move forward and reclaim their lives. Each IVR follows its own timeline, and the accountability is different for each veteran. If they want an associate's degree in nursing, they're probably going to be here for 2 years. Others who have necessary job skills but need to work on life skills and financial literacy may only be here a few months, Turner explains. The center is the result of more than a decade of planning and persuasive fundraising, much of it led by Turner, and the end result is a public-private partnership that has raised roughly $20 million and has an annual operating budget of $2.5 million. Turner knows what it's like to transition from the military back to civilian life. He served in the U.S. Coast Guard from 1992 to 1996, and after 9/11, he enlisted in the U.S. Army, 2003 to 2007. Sitting in a tent in Baghdad in 2006, Turner didn't know he was going to lead the fight to build the VLC, but he did know he was going to return home on a mission to build support for America's military operations and its veterans. From a town hall meeting at the Cary VFW, Post 7383, to presentations in Washington, D.C., and at the North Carolina General Assembly, Turner repeatedly called on political leaders and the business community to support at-risk veterans. In 2017, the General Assembly awarded a $7.8 million HUD Community Development Block Grant, at that time the largest CDBG ever awarded in the state, to finance construction of the VLC. The SECU Foundation made a $1 million donation and earned naming rights for the building to become the Veterans Life Center CQ Veterans Residence. And donations have continued to pour in, including support from some of the state's largest corporate citizens, from Duke Energy to Bank of America, which wrote a $75,000 check in 2019. Between private money and grants, we need to continually produce about $850,000 a year, Turner says. This year, we raised $750,000, and the state matches this. In fact, it's a recurring item in the state budget, so the state will continue to match up to $750,000 a year. With only 18 months of operating history, it's hard to quantify the success of the VLC to date, although Turner proudly reports, "We had 234 veterans who slept here over the last year." An impressive benchmark given the constraints that COVID-19 placed on residential facilities. The 50-room facility has capacity for 100 residents, but occupancy was limited during the pandemic. Currently, the resident population is predominantly made up of male veterans, 88%, with just 12% female residents. However, the VLC is structured to serve a more balanced makeup, 76% male, 24% female. "We're still in the phase of trying to prove our concept, but the outcomes so far are different than what I expected," Turner says. "COVID has made the challenges greater. Substance abuse is higher, mental health is a bigger challenge, and there is less care available. It turns out that getting veterans to seek help and getting them enrolled in programs is more challenging. For instance, I overestimated the ease of getting them enrolled in community college programs and underestimated the importance of doing that." The South Campus of Vance Granville Community College is located 3 miles from the VLC, and many residents attend classes there or virtual classes with other colleges. "Around here, the Vance Granville sweatshirts might as well say Harvard if you could see the pride of these veterans when they get a letter back from the community college that they've been accepted," Turner says. "They may be 30 years old, haven't been in a classroom since high school, and spent the last 5 or 6 years struggling with periods of homelessness, but now they can believe in themselves again." That sense of belonging and renewed self-reliance helps position the veterans to fully transition into the civilian workforce, but the critical last mile is finding business leaders who will serve as mentors, provide internship opportunities, and ultimately offer a job and a career path where the veterans can succeed. Frank and Margaret Ballard, owners of Hayes Barton Cafe and Dessertery in Raleigh's Five Points neighborhood, have been involved with the VLC for years and have supported veterans since they opened the restaurant in 1998. "This restaurant is a tribute to my parents who came here in 1950 after Dad served as a sailor in World War II," Frank Ballard says. "Over the years, they've held fundraisers for veterans and supported the VLC with donations." "We're in a unique position because we have 3 or 4 employees who've been with us the entire 24 years we've been open, and our bartender has been with us for 18 years, Ballard says. "It's a miracle we were able to keep our staff through COVID. We just don't have any turnover. If we did, I'd welcome hiring one of these VLC residents who are transitioning back into civilian society." Walking through the facility with Turner, he speaks to every resident by name, and he encourages Triangle business leaders to give him a call and come for a visit, not only to see the facility, but more importantly, to meet the veterans. "What they'll see is that our residents will be great employees for them one day. They're not just donating time or money to the facility, they're investing in veterans and in their future workforce." And we also have 2 news items in the 52 Shades of Success section. analysis, costs to attend HBCUs vary widely. Affordability is a very relative term when it comes to the cost of attending an HBCU. A recent analysis of the annual net cost to attend a historically black college or university, HBCU, revealed wide disparities. Within North Carolina, the most expensive HBCU has an annual cost nearly 10 times greater than the most affordable HBCU. Using data from the U.S. Department of Education College Scorecard, Student Loan Hero, a division of LendingTree, ranked HBCU affordability based on annual expenses, including tuition, room and board, and books, and factoring in annual grants and scholarships. And the lowest priced is Elizabeth City State University, $2,350. The most expensive, Bennett College, $21,356. LGBTQ by generation. According to a recent Gallup poll, more than 7% of U.S. adults identified as LGBTQ in 2021, up from 3.5% in 2012. Generationally, the statistics skew young. Gen Z, 20.8% identify as LGBTQ. Millennials, 10.5%. Gen X, 4.2%. And baby boomers, 2.6%. And finally, we'll read as much as we can of this general news story. Why some North Carolina businesses are getting rejected for $500 million grant, written by Laura Brumette. When the North Carolina Department of Revenue launched the Business Recovery Grant Program in December, it promised help for businesses with significant economic losses due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But the program's eligibility requirements cut out some companies in need. The $500 million program, now on pause, was designed to provide North Carolina businesses with a one-time payment using federal funding from the American Rescue Plan Act. Applications for the first phase of the program ended January 31, and about 2,000 businesses have received money from the fund so far, according to the North Carolina Department of Revenue. But many did not, which came as a surprise to hundreds of businesses in the state. The issue? Sales tax. If companies did not collect sales tax from the customers, they were ineligible to receive money from the grant program. And we'll have to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.